I don't think there's going to be a huge gap between us, because we're obviously all opposed to the trade union, but it's just exactly the tactics we believe in. I mean, obviously the Socialist Party believes in a complete change in society, and that's how we'll oppose it in the main, but we'll leave it to our speaker to explain that better.
You just took it off for me, I think we've got home.
Yeah, even until 4:30, to be honest. So, Bill Martin's representing the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and Tosh MacDonald speaking, I don't know what capacity, a national president of ASLEF, but then...
I better do it as that, because I'm not here with authority at Labour Party. So.
Yes, we're not yet expelled, really.
You're not disowning the Labour Party already, are you?
Oh, no, no.
Right, so I don't know who wants to speak first. We'll have, about 20 minutes each, is that what you're planning on? Obviously, if you want to overrun, you can, there's plenty of time. And then we'll have questions and contributions, and then we'll have about 10 minutes for each speaker to wind up at the end. So I don't know who wants to start first.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, by all means. Excuse me standing up, I do that so I can see my notes rather than anything else. Thanks for the invite. It's I enjoyed speaking at your thing in the railway in September, I think that was, wasn't it?
It was.
That was quite interesting. Mm, and different views from the left in British politics, I suppose. But there we go. Anyway, always happy to come back and to talk about the trade union bill. Now, one of the things, obviously, things have moved on since you first contacted me about this bill. And one of the things I always like to make is that the trade union bill is not something that stands alone. I heard many people on the left, many trade union leaders and politicians standing up and saying this is the worst attack we've ever seen. Well, it's not. It's just part of the same attack. But this Tory party that's in government, and they are the most successful class-based party in British politics, in the history of British politics, and everything they do, whether it's this trade union laws, the trade union laws in the 70s and 80s, whether it's the bedroom tax, benefits cuts, boundary changes, single-tier pension, doing away with default retirement age and zero-hours contracts, all them are part of the same attack on our class. They're not a separate thing, it's an attack that they make. And the best way to fight the TU bill and all the other issues is to fight it on all fronts. Yeah, we fight it politically, but if you think it's going to be solved and beat in the Houses of Parliament or in council chambers or in Labour Party meetings or trade union meetings or trade union officers for that matter, you've got another thing coming. That's not going to happen. It has to be out on the streets. And that's why I'm glad John's here from People's Assembly in Doncaster, because I think the work that the People's Assembly's been doing on a number of issues against the austerities, getting people mobilised and out on the streets and doing stuff, I think is fantastically. We need to fight it industrially, obviously. And should some of the worst parts of the bill have come in, and the remnants of it when it comes in, if that makes it impossible for us as trade unions to look after the interests of our members inside the law, then we have no alternative but to look after them outside the law. And we mustn't fall for the concessions that's been won against the trade union bill so far. A lot of the issues that have been conceded, whether it's in the Commons, in the Lords, or wherever, were lost leaders anyway that were put up. Yeah, the stuff, if they had a bigger majority, and they would love to have in these Tories, they'd love to have them in, but there were things they were happy to lose anyway to get the mainstay of the trade union bill in. Now, it's probably worth looking at the things that, the successes that we have had, and I think the successes that we have had are a little bit of justification of what I'm saying, that needs to be fought on all fronts, and I think it's had some success. They've abandoned the plans to ban union subscriptions being taken from Chekhov, provided the union pays for that. Well, we always have anyway, certainly in our industry. I don't know about other industries. One exception to that is in ScotRail, where we pay the company for the doing Chekhov for us, taking the union subs out of our members' wages, but the money we give them, they give us back to use for training. So that's the only exception I know to it. There may be others. They've conceded some safeguards against the politicisation at certification officer, and they're going to reduce the cost to the unions. But the costs are still going up from what they are now, and the unions shouldn't be paying for somebody to investigate them, as far as we're concerned. They've watered down plans to restrict the union's political funds. They're now no longer saying it's going to apply to existing members, and the costs and effort will be much reduced. So I think that will appease a lot in the Labour Party, to be quite honest, because that was their big fear. It's not ours. Our big fear as a trade union is that we have to be able to look after our members. The political voice is part of that, but I think the Labour Party's fear was the loss of funding they were going to get through the trade union bill. They've also agreed to review the online methods for strike ballots, which would increase turnouts. Now, I have no problem with online ballots and increasing the turnouts and trying to get more people involved, but I don't think that's really that much of a concession. It's something that we should have been campaigning for anyway. There's also safety guards going to be given to the power to cap union facility time. And the safeguards are that can only happen after at least 3 years of research and negotiation, but it can still happen. These Tories, as I've said, they're the most successful class-based party. They have a long-term aim. They don't do it to just try and get in and see what they can do in one term of office. In 3 years' time, should this come in, we're talking about then a year away from the election, they can look at bringing in what the hell they want then, as long as negotiations have been taken. It's just put it on a back burner for a while. Concessions had already been made before last week when that happened. The extreme measures to restrict pickets, protests and having to give you information and social media campaigns, plans to have everybody, people with armbands on and giving the personal data to police, they've been dropped. You know, they were extreme even to the views of some of the Tory MPs. So it's just, like I say, a loss leader that was put in there makes it look like they've given a lot up. Really, they haven't. They scaled back the double threshold for strike ballots in important public services, and to avoid capturing hundreds and thousands of ancillary workers being caught up into it, agency staff that have been working in an industry. There's still some very harmful proposals that could become law, but the bill that's been passed in Commons last week is vastly reduced from what they first intended on. And a lot of that has to be said, you know, thanks to everybody who took part, who marched on the streets, who did online petitions, whatever they did. But there's also loads of stuff to come in, secondary legislation, regulations to come in, codes of practice still to be published. All of these we've got to be trying to find. Now, the campaigns, like I say, like people like the People's Assembly have done, like the trade unions have all done individually, and the Labour Party has been good in it, has been good with emails, signed petitions, held local events, joint consultation exercises, told personal stories on billboard campaigns, and took part in the biggest ever lobby of MPs. All them things are important. None of them is the single way to fight it. But we also have to start looking at doing some stuff maybe outside the law, should this come in, and maybe to fight it as well. We need to be on the streets in other ways, I believe, and fight on all fronts. Because, you know, it's not just in Parliament and council chambers that it's going to happen. Union officers, as I said before. And I think our political representatives, and to a great extent some trade union leaders, have not been up to it in the past. They haven't been up to the job. And when we see Labour Party conference, union conferences, we see polished presentations taking place where they've got their autocues and things. That's all well and good. But many of them, you know, can't address an angry meeting. They've not grown up cutting the teeth in an angry trade union meeting where they've had to more or less fight their way out of a room sometime. So they haven't got that ability. And unions certainly bear some blame for that. You know, what we've done historically, certainly in this area, actually, I remember Trades Council in Doncaster years ago, in sort of the early 80s when I used to be a regular at it, there was loads, big, massive, they used to have two big rooms where they opened the doors between them in the Trades Club at Doncaster for it to take place. The NUM would all sit along on a table with stuff out there, and it was very strong. But you know what we did? Anybody who was any good, we kept them for in the unions. If they weren't that good, but they were good time servers, they turned up whenever you needed them to, but they weren't up to scratch. We used to put them in positions in Labour Party. We did. And it's not really the best thing we did, because we not only did that, we then cut them free. And it's almost Labour folklore in this part of Yorkshire, where years ago, when a certain industrial union that doesn't exist and it's in the same form now, wanted a certain individual to become a branch secretary around this area, and the members didn't think that individual was up for it, so they voted somebody else in. As compensation for that guy not getting to be the branch secretary, the block vote was used to get him selected, and he became an MEP. Now, that was the trade unions not taking things seriously at that time, and I think now we have to. One example of taking action maybe outside the law, from round here, I don't know how many is from this area, not, but I'm sure you've all heard of the South Yorkshire Freedom Riders by now, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, in 2014, the end of March 2014, the local authorities, the South Yorkshire PTE, decided, with all the cuts being forced on them from national level, from central government, they were going to take away the free travel on the trains for pensioners and for disabled people. If they've got a bus pass, after 9 o'clock, they used to be able to travel on trains as well, and they took that away from them as a cut. The Freedom Riders then, instead of meeting in Barnsley, it started, and there was a meeting with 300 of them turned up at Barnsley Library and decided that they were going to have Freedom Rides, as they called them. They took the name from the Freedom Trains that were used to get slaves out of Southern America at times. And what they did, they decided on 31st, on to 1st of April, or was it Monday might have been the day before, the day up to that day they'd been able to use their pass and get on a train anywhere in South Yorkshire. So they rolled up to Barnsley Station, they rolled up to Sheffield Station and to Doncaster Station, and they all showed the passes just as they had before to the conductor on the train, with placards saying we're Freedom Riders and demanding their concessions back. And they all travelled from the three places, Doncaster, Sheffield and Barnsley, met up at Meadowhall, and between the platforms at Meadowhall there's a big grassy hill, and that's where they held the first rally. Now, I was pleased to be contacted by them. I was in a meeting in Brussels, the International European Transport Workers Federation, which they could send a glass eye to sleep, I tell you. So I was happy to get this message. And it was from one of the Freedom Riders. In fact, he's the chair of Barnsley Trades Council, a guy called Dave Gibson. Told me what they were doing. The next one was going to be the following Monday. Could I send a message of support? Actually, one of our members had given my card as he drove the train into Barnsley Station, saw him get on. When they got off at Meadowhall, the driver called him and gave him my card, said, contact him, he'll help you with your fight. So I said, I can do better than sending you a message. I'm in Yorkshire, I'll come and address you, which I did. I've supported the Freedom Riders ever since. They got the concession back for disabled people, and they got half-price fares back for pensioners. They've also pushed with Stagecoach in South Yorkshire, that they, if they've got the bus pass, they can't use till 9:30. If they've got an hospital appointment, anything, they can use it prior to 9:30 for free. There's some of the smaller bus companies giving them a flat £1 fare for the pensioners. That's fighting against the cuts and taking direct action, and I have full support for that, and that's part of what we need to be doing against all the attacks, not just the trade union bill. Now, I don't believe any of the Labour councillors in Doncaster, Sheffield, Rotherham, Barnsley or wherever got into local politics to make cuts. I don't believe any of them did that. Certainly on the Labour Party side. Some of them you get a bit dubious about, but I don't think anybody really did. And I do believe that they think they're making the cuts as fairly as possible, and they prefer that to handing it to central government to make the cuts for them. We can argue about whether they're correct or not. I don't believe all the things they're doing are correct, but that's what they believe. Now, where I have a real problem with them is instead of standing with the Freedom Riders and saying, you know, we pay Northern Rail £700 million a year as taxpayers to run a service. Now, I have no problem with paying taxpayers' money to run a service for the public. But Northern Rail are taking £40 million a year out in profit of that taxpayers' money. Why then should we pay them extra to carry disabled people and passengers off-peak times when they're running around with empty seats? It's the same diesel charges or electric charges. It's the same track access charges. They're paying the same staff costs. Why should we pay them extra? And instead of the councillors having a go at the Freedom Riders, and I've been accused by a good friend of mine who was a councillor in Sheffield and used to sit on the Transport Committee, said to me, Tosh, you're dancing with the trots, because I'm supporting people who are natural supporters of Labour and our movement rather than supporting the councillors who have made these cuts. And I think they should be stood shoulder to shoulder with them. When the Freedom Riders went to Northern Rail's headquarters in York, massed outside it, demanding to see them, the South Yorkshire councillors who had to make these cuts, felt they were forced to make these cuts, should have been stood with them, demanding that Northern Rail take this, let them travel for free off-peak when there's empty seats. An MP from Barnsley, I spoke at a meeting a few weeks back where he was, and he just kept drinking water and sliding further down tables as I was talking. And he's supposed to be a war hero, Dan Jarvis, I think, isn't he? I think he'd run a mile if he saw an angry Afghan, to be quite honest. But he referred to the Freedom Riders as a nuisance. The natural supporters, just like the Care UK strikers in Doncaster were for over a year, and you never saw an MP anywhere near them. You saw a couple of councillors, and credit to them. I've been on the picket lines with the junior doctors, and I've seen a councillor there with them, credit to her as well, and shame on those who haven't been down there. Now, I started on railway in 79 as a freight guard, and Thatcher got elected that same year. I saw him through minor strike and I've seen many changes, I saw many attacks. But I think what we've got now, more than 3.5 decades later, is the best chance we've had as a Labour and socialist movement to see effect real change on society. And a lot of that does have to be, whether you like him or not, has to be put down to the Corbyn effect. I think the Corbyn effect, it got a momentum going, it got people enthused. And it wasn't new, you know, because when Gordon Brown got coronated as the leader at Labour Party and John McDonnell were trying to get in the race for leader, and he couldn't get enough MPs to nominate him. But I went round with John McDonnell then, that's a good while ago, I can't remember exactly what year it was, but it must be 8, 9, maybe 10 years ago now, I don't know. And I went round speaking on platforms with John McDonnell. And I remember being in Newcastle on St Patrick's Day, which was a Saturday afternoon, and in the big hotel on Newcastle Station there, we had a huge room there, every seat was full, the aisles were full and standing, and the corridor were full and standing. So this feeling of people to want to get involved in something different that politics we've been used to over decades has been there a long time. Now, Corbyn got the required number of MPs to set him in the race, and he struggled to get that. There was minutes to go, let's be quite honest about it. But the massive support that he got from members, affiliated members, and registered supporters. It was a massive mandate, the biggest mandate that any Labour Party leader had got. The only people he didn't have the support for were the parliamentary party. As I say, he struggled to get nominations. Some of them people said they only give him a nomination to allow a proper debate. Like some of them now regret it. But what is fair? New Labour people attacked him during the election campaign. They even wheeled Blair out again. Did you see, with the progress banners behind him, they wheeled Blair out. I think that helped Corbyn get elected as leader, to be quite honest. Yeah. But it's September, wasn't it, when the leadership election took place? But it took a hell of a job, minutes to spare before he got enough MPs to nominate him. And a few months later, there was the vote on bombing Syria. And I'm not happy with the result of that vote in Commons. And I was quite angry. After a day or so, as I start to analyse things, and I looked at it, you know, actually, on a free vote, you can argue whether it were right to be a free vote or not. I think they should have had a whip on it, to be quite honest. But with it being a free vote, 80% of the parliamentary party voted with the leader who'd been elected by the massive majority of the members. 80%. The media obviously concentrated on the 20%. And what I will say is I will never forgive Hilary Benn for what he said in the House of Commons. One, there's nothing wrong with somebody who's got on the conscience decides to vote against the whip, well, there weren't even a whip there, but to speak against the leader in what was really nothing more than a writer reply by proxy for David Cameron, to get the Tory front benches giving him a standing ovation after his speech, all that's bad enough. But when he compared bombing Syria with the international brigaders who went to fight in Spain, I personally find that unforgivable. Unforgivable. In fact, it has more in common with what Hitler and Mussolini's air forces were doing, bombing the Republican side in Spain, than it does with the international brigaders. And I will never forget that. Then we got the reshuffle taking place, because that was all leaders have had reshuffles, and we got ministers or shadow cabinet members resigning on television, live on television. They're not doing this for any other reason than to try and undermine Corbyn and the momentum that is being built up, not just within Labour Party, within our movement. And I was watching this as it happened on telly, on news, that 24-hour news on BBC, and there's a banner comes across the bottom, Minister resigns. And I seen this guy, he looked like he could do with a good roast beef and Yorkshire pudding dinner, to be honest. Cut walking out, Minister resigns. I thought, who the hell's he? Shadow Cabinet member resigns, who the hell's he? Then his name come up, Jonathan Reynolds. I still didn't know who the hell he was. And then his job came up, he was Shadow Rail Minister. Now, I'm sorry, if I'm the president of the largest rail union that's affiliated to the Labour Party and I don't know who the Shadow Rail Minister is, there's something wrong. But I didn't just take it at that. I asked every one of the executive committee members in Haslef, not one of them knew who he was. I asked all the officers, not one of them knew. The two national officers, the national organiser, he didn't know. The general secretary knew who he was because he'd once shared a platform at a fringe with him. The only time the general secretary had ever met him. Now, compare that with Andy MacDonald, who's now the Shadow Rail Minister. Within 24 hours, he'd rung and spoke to me, he'd spoke to the General Secretary and the National Organiser, and we have met several times since to to work together on what's best for the industry. And that's all part of what's been wrong in the past and why we haven't been able to fight things in the past with friends in Parliament, because it's been more like a job club and they're more interested in getting a position in the Cabinet or Shadow Cabinet to stick on CV as they move up that slippery pole. If you've got a position, you should at least be communicating and in touch with the people who work in that sector of society you're supposed to be representing. Now, another part of all this, and it does get, but I'm not talking just about Labour Party, I'm getting back round to how we fight things. Because another part of this, if we're fighting it, we've got to fight those who are supposedly within our side of politics who are fighting against us. And the anti-Semitism thing that's taking place in the Labour Party now, it's part of these same attacks. Because there are these people in the Labour Party, mainly in the Parliamentary Labour Party, who are part of New Labour, who still are part of New Labour, who are part of the Labour Friends of Israel. They're very powerful people within the party. They have very powerful backers and they have a lot of finance behind them. And their influence, they see it being threatened. There's no place in Labour Party, in the movement or in society for any kind of racism or bigotry. But we have to be able to criticise and campaign against the Israeli atrocities in Palestine without being accused of Semitism for doing it. Think of the timing of it. You know, I believe there are people who want control of the Labour Party who don't care how many seats we lose in these upcoming elections on Thursday. They want it to damage Corbyn and they will stand a Progress New Labour candidate against him. Now, I'm confident when they do that, they'll lose. They'll lose, but the only thing they're doing is showing divisions. The divisions isn't in the Labour Party. I don't think the whole of the Labour movement is that divided, to be quite honest. But these people are wanting to show divisions because they see their influence being put under threat. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit as well about the EU, because I think that comes into how we fight to defend trade unions and against trade union bills. The Labour conference unanimously voted to campaign to stay in Europe. Can't argue with that, they did. We as a union voted for that. We were promised, you know, at that time, that they'd learn the lessons from the Better Together campaign. That was the campaign in the Scottish independence referendum when Labour got in bed with the Tories and the Liberals and anybody else who wanted to stay together, and it damaged us unbelievably. Now, I think Corbyn and MacDonald are doing the right thing. They're two leading figures in a political party whose democratic position is to campaign to stay in the European Union. And what they're saying, if you hear them, they're saying we want to be better in Europe, we should have a more social Europe, we should have more workers' rights built into that. That's what they believe, and I think they're doing the right thing, because they're the leaders of a party whose conference decided that. When you look at Alan Johnson, Neil Kinnock and Alistair Darling, when you see them getting into bed again after the promises that were made with the Tories, the Lib Dems and the SNP, just to get where they want to be, where they believe they should be, they're nothing but liars and untrustworthy. That again damages us so much. We're the ones who are honest. It's the left that's honest in politics, whether it's in the Labour Party or outside the Labour Party. And these people, they're basically interlopers, I suppose. If they could have got on a Tory party, I'm sure a lot of them would be in the Tory party. Now, we as a union, our democratic processes, we're campaigning to come out of Europe. We see the fourth railway package confronting us. The fourth railway package, for anybody who doesn't know, coming through European legislation now, imposes the British model of rail privatisation on the whole of the EU. It's already coming in Belgium, and it will eventually come in everywhere. So should we now? We've got a leadership in Labour Party, we've got a conference decision in Labour Party to bring the railway back into public ownership. Should we be in the EU as that happens, we won't be able to do it. So that's one of the reasons we're campaigning to come out. Interoperability is another one that's being brought in the rail industry through the EU. Interoperability means that companies from Poland, from wherever, will be able to bid for freight contracts and whatever in the UK. Now, we have no problem with the free movement of labour. We have no problem with people being able to do that. What we say they should do, if a company from Poland with Polish train drivers wins that contract, they should be protected by the best, not the worst. If the British conditions where they're getting the contract are better than the Polish ones, they should get them, or vice versa. And we have an history of this, where in the 90s, there was a group, there were shortages down on the south coast, there were new tracks being laid, we needed people to work them trains, there wasn't anybody, they couldn't recruit down there in the south. And so what they did, they brought agency train drivers from Germany and Holland. Now, our members there said they're not having that. They didn't say they didn't want people from Germany and Holland coming. They said if they're coming, they come and they work on the same terms, the same conditions and the same pay as us. And we still have some German and Dutch train drivers working in the south 20-odd years on now. That is the way it should be done. This protection should be there, not a drive to the bottom. It should be about increasing people's wages. That's interoperability. The second thing that we couldn't support staying in Europe for. The next one is the European train driver licence. Again, we've spent years, decades in fact. It used to be as a train driver, if you had an heart attack, had heart surgery, a bypass or anything, you couldn't drive trains anymore unless you could get a job in a siding somewhere or in a yard shunting. If you were like me, you were a diabetic, you couldn't drive on the main line anymore. All these illnesses and many more we've fought. We've classed them as disabilities and we've got safety equipment in trains these days, in modern trains. It's not like the old steam engines anymore. Where the safety devices, should you fail on any reason. So we fought to get people back. One guy, I can tell you, from Hull, it took us 6 years when he became insulin dependent on diabetes. We got him back. 6 years it took to get him back driving. They're now introducing this European train driver licence that brings in stricter medical standards, even though we have far better safety equipment in the cabs now, and all the work we've done for years will be gone. Let's look at TTIP. Everybody here must know what an abhorrent abomination TTIP is, which enshrines privatisation in all our industry, all our society. And when you see people in Labour Party, the best we do see from some of the new Labour people is that they would campaign to get the NHS taken out of it. Even with the NHS out of it, it's still abhorrent and it should be opposed. Then look at Solvency II. I don't know how many people know about what Solvency II was. It is in now, but we got pensions in Britain taken out of it. And now they're trying to reintroduce them to them. In Britain, basically, out of the whole of Europe, we're the only ones with a kind of occupational pension schemes that most of us, I hope, get to enjoy, where we're paying into an occupational pension scheme. I'm paying for pension as a railway pension scheme. We're already drawing it now. People who come after me will pay for mine, all being well. Solvency II brings pensions in Britain in line with all of the financial institutions, and it says that you must keep enough money there to pay everybody out tomorrow should you need to. Now, you're never going to need to. And if we had to do that, I sit as a trustee of two pension schemes, and if we had to do that, we wouldn't be able to survive. The pension scheme it lives on its investment, on its income coming in, not on what it has old sitting in a book. But with all them things that really affected us as train drivers and our members as train drivers, the overlying thing that made us say we couldn't ask our members to support staying in Europe was what happened in Greece. And we see the people in Greece struggling, and we saw them not wanting to carry on with austerity and cuts, and we saw Europe and the European Central Bank telling them they've got to have austerity, and not only that, they've got to sell off their national assets to the privateers. Why on earth would we want to be part of an organisation that would do that to the people of a country of Europe? What we have said is we won't share platforms with bigots, we won't go on a platform with Tories or UKIP who want to be out of Europe, because ours is a different argument. It's not about xenophobia and it's not about little Englanders. But there's this thing I want to finish on now, and I say this at a lot of meetings because it's the thing that inspires me when I read about trade union history in Britain and how we can fight it, and we don't necessarily have to stick to law to fight things. In January 1942, when miners at Bettsanger Colliery near Deal in Kent struck for 19 days, it was in breach of the wartime emergency regulations on compulsory arbitration. The Ministry of Labour decided to prosecute 1,050 miners. The lot took three local union officials, and thousands of strikers were fined. Other pits and other workers in area came out. Illegally, they weren't allowed to do it because of wartime legislation. And what ended up happening is the Home Secretary dropped the prison sentences and no fines were ever paid. But more than that, representatives of the Home Secretary had to go to the prisons in Kent and beg the miners' leaders to come out so they'd go back to work. So what's the best way to fight the trade union bill? It's every front is where we have to be fighting. I'll fight in Labour Party, maybe you don't want to fight in there, but we'll fight when we march on streets with People's Assembly. We'll fight in as trade unions, and we'll fight in campaigns that are taking place in the local communities, like the Freedom Riders, like the Care UK and the Junior Doctors. That's how we fight it, by taking action on all fronts. Thank you. Can I have a run?
No. You did in about 25 minutes, but not drastically over. We've certainly got plenty of time. Anyway, we'd all been upset about it. Cut you short. Right, so Bill, yes.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Just to begin, I'd like to actually take credit for Jeremy Corbyn's rise to the Labour leadership. Some of you in the room may know I actually stood against him in Islington North at the last general election. And he must have come out of that thinking, well, I'll send that Bill Martin off, so yeah, I can take on the world now. So, it's a pleasure. Thank you. He must have cried over every one of those 112 votes I got.
How many?
Quite good for us.
Most of those were me with my own crayon in the ballot. Okay. Joking aside, you have to forgive me if what I'm saying is a bit ABC, Janet and John, but I think the good scientific method involves going back to basics and stating what seems to be the blindingly obvious, because it's through re-examining the blindingly obvious that sometimes we come to new and fresh conclusions. So what I'm going to start with is an analysis of our contemporary society, how it's largely organised, and in particular how that relates to the wages system, and in turn how the trade unions take their place within that, and how the state relates to the trade union's role within current society, and I'm going to use that as the basis for examining some of the options that we face when confronting the state and things like the trade union bill, and I'm going to come ineluctably to my essential conclusion that what we need is political action backed up by a mass movement. Remarkably different, I'm sure, from what Tosh was just saying, but with subtle differences along the way, so we'll see how it works out. You have to forgive me, I've had this permacough since Christmas. I think it's the London smog or something. Okay, so we live in a society that's characterised by generalised commodity production, that is, that almost everything you need to get in life can only be obtained through an exchange with another commodity, and usually that commodity is money. So everything is for sale, everything can be bought and sold, and that the price we pay, the rate we exchange them at, to cut a very long story short, is the amount of effort it would take to either obtain or make a new example of the particular type of good or service that we want to obtain. And this is true of pretty much anything you need in order to live. And you cannot live without having money or exchangeable goods in order to get money. And that's true for the vast majority of us in this world, in this country. You know, people talk about national identity and all sorts of things. The vast majority of us do not own a single square inch of the United Kingdom. We just live and work here. And we live and work here by selling our ability to work. That's the only commodity we have. We don't have land with resources on it. We don't have factories. We don't have copyrights, legal instruments or things like that. We only have our abstract ability to work, which we sell to an employer. And our employers then use that ability to work to create goods and services for them, which they then sell in turn as part of generalised commodity production. And this is significant because this is the source of their profits. And this is, and I want to emphasise it, Karl Marx's one true, genuine contribution to economic science and to the labour movement was finding this distinction between labour and labour power, between our ability to work and the work that we do. So our ability to work is a commodity just like any other, and it is sold, bought and sold, just like any other, and it is priced in exactly the same way. We're not paid according to the skills we have, we're not paid according to how hard we work, we're not paid according to any sort of moral or any personal capacity. We're paid according to how easy or difficult it is to replace us and find another person who can do the same type of work as us. And that's the difference between that cost of finding someone to do our work and the work that we do is the source of all profits. And we can all find, go online and find the graphs. As profits go up, wages as a share of the economy go down, and as wages as a share of the economy go up, profits as a share of the economy go down. This is the heart of the class struggle that Tosh alluded to, and it's very clear that the only way that they can make us, that they can make their profits, is through us. And it's, I want to emphasise very strongly, this is not, they're not underpaying us, they're paying a fair day's pay for a fair day's labour. And that is how we are exploited. Exactly how. So what Marx brought to the table is the sure and certain knowledge that it is the payment of wages and salaries themselves that are how we are exploited. And I think this has to be borne in mind in any discussion on trade union and the workers' movement. So, bearing in mind that it's the, just the cost of our replaceability that our employers have to pay us, that means that what trade unions do is that they streamline this bargaining process and the buying and selling of our ability to work, and in certain circumstances they can make it harder to replace us. Tosh gave examples of when solidarity strikes come along and therefore people refuse to join the pool of unemployed, and therefore mean that we can strike a bargain with a particular employer in a local instance much better. But this fundamentally relates to what Marx called the reserve army of labour, what we call unemployment, and the present time that we've all been experiencing for the last 40-odd years has been based on a standing, since the mid-1970s, a standing pool of well in excess of 1 million unemployed, and that determines pretty much everything that goes on in the labour movement. So I'm sure Tosh could say, you know, that, you know, trade unionists up and down the country, or not, and pretty much any national executive would love to be storming the barricades, would love to be out there, you know, telling the bosses what to do and pushing them back. But the fact of the matter is that their memberships are sitting around going, well, I'm very worried about my job, and therefore very unwilling to strike action. This happened in my workplace. We had a strike ballot which we actually won by about 10 votes. And as a consequence of that very slender majority, we decided not to go ahead with strike action, despite actually winning the ballot, partly because of the provisions of the trade union law that mean that you can't expel people who don't go on legitimately mandated strikes. That's what conditions, what happens with our trade unions. And in fact, things like the Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act, which I think is still the main thing, that sets out what our trade union rule books have to be. That's set out in statute. Pretty much everything in a trade union is there, what you can and cannot do. You know, the state determines it. And it's the state that comes in and regulates this relationship between ourselves and our employers, whereby we strike a bargain to be exploited. And if you go to the courts, one of the things that you'll find is that, in fact, in the courts, they still talk about it as a master-servant relationship. That one side of the contract of service is the master and the other is the servant. The courts know how things stand, and that's the underlying reality. And of course, the state is not a neutral actor in this. It's not something that's standing by, you know, as a referee between ourselves and our employers as we negotiate these struggles. It is a very much an interested actor working on behalf of the most powerful, the most organised sections of society that are in control of most of the infrastructure, and ultimately through various mechanisms of finance, ownership of the press, funding of political parties, that it's the wealthy that stand behind the state and it works in their interest. And a lot of ink has been spilled on the question of what is the state. And political theorists have written vasty tomes, largely because the state very often is whatever it wants to be, because ultimately what state relationship is it is organised lethal force, and it's the organised lethal force that stands at the back of society, and it is the one that is the most, it's not the sole or the monopoly, but it's certainly the largest and most preponderant, and there are no substantial rivals to that state power. And in countries that are known as failed states, it usually is that there is a substantial rival that can challenge. So in a mafia state, the Mafia are a real rival to the power, state power, because they also know the power of giving someone a contract they cannot refuse. But what the so the state stands for, in the interests of a certain section of society, the employers, those who benefit from the exploitation of wage labour. And of course, the state could do anything it wants, because ultimately, you know, yes, okay, most of the time it's just a fine, or it's just imprisonment, but, you know, if you escape from prison, if you refuse to pay the fine, it will, you know, eventually comes down to they will come at you with sufficient force that either you kill them or they kill you. And that's what the backs the state up. It could do anything it likes. It could reintroduce slavery. And in some countries in the past, you know, within the last 100 years, they have just gone, okay, well, we're not going to bother with this wage relationship anymore. We're just going to have straight-up slavery. They could have, the state could just directly employ people. The state could just give wealth to people as it wishes. But because the state itself represents a certain continuing interest, it's limited by the interests of those employers who wish to continue exploiting wage labour. And that is the one limiting factor. If they want the labour market to continue happening, then they have to continue allowing those conditions and the basic ones that we've explored, and that Tosh outlined with his example of the miners striking at the end of the war, that if you have wage workers, if you have free workers, if you have this special commodity labour power that comes with a human being attached, then you always have the possibility of a strike, of resistance, of a refusal of the contract, and it's inherent. And as long as that obtains, all the state can really do is raise the cost of striking, ultimately to the cost of fatality, if it so chooses. So it can impose burdens, as the famous Taft Vale decision, which said that striking was a restraint of trade, and therefore they fined the trade union for organising. That was the birth of the Labour Party. It raised the cost of organising strikes to the point at which you would no longer have standing trade unions that could survive between and negotiate between strikes. But of course, what would happen if you didn't have them is you would have ad hoc trade unions, you'd have ad hoc strikes, you'd have wildcats, or other forms of unofficial action taking place from time to time based on the balance of the current labour market and the conditions therein. And of course, a lot of employers basically still do value the thing that the trade unions bring to the negotiating table, which is consistency, experience. I mean, I've not been doing much trade union work because I've been slightly too high in management these days to do it. But when I was there going, well, I've gone through this process 3 or 4 times, and you as a manager, you've never done it before once. So I know what I'm doing, the HR rep knows what they're doing, we'll hold your hand and tell you. And at the time I felt very much, this relates to the facility time issue, that I was an underpaid manager, because that's what I was doing. I was doing the management job for them. So the trade union bill is an aspect of this state power, this reliance on the use of force. And as we can see, for most of the provisions within it are just about being obstructive, about making it harder to strike, not actually banning striking or outlawing it whatsoever. But even when there's been various restrictions and it's been, you know, majority strikes, there have been wildcat strikes that have been successful. I remember probably 16 years ago there were some CWU strikes that were just wildcat walkouts that won. It can still happen. But one of the main benefits for the Tories of the current trade union bill is it's been a tool to try and keep the trade unions quiet, because while they're busy fighting that and worried about it, particularly when the officials are worried about the effects, which affect them much more than it would the members in the first instance, much down the line the members would get affected, it's been a stick to hold over their heads. And that's probably why it's probably been a big mistake of the Tories to trade that stick away for some money to help them out of the hole with the Euro vote that happened just the other day. I don't know if you saw that apparently the trade unions have agreed to put millions of pounds now into the pro-Euro campaign or something like that.
Substantial
amounts of money are coming from the TUC or something like that. But anyway, yes. But in return for a lot of those concessions that you just that Tosh outlined earlier on. So how could we oppose the state? As I've said, it is the preponderant use of force in society. Well, one way is to demonstrate that there is a significant force that could take it on, that there is a movement that could be so much trouble that it's not worth spilling lots of blood to take it down, because the state wants stability, it wants to maintain profitability for its patrons. So you can do simple things. It's the campaigning handbook. You can write petitions, sign petitions. You can hold marches, and you can strike. The first thing, difficulty is demonstrating that you have sufficient willpower and sufficient numbers on your side to be an obstacle to state power and to threaten it. So, they will ignore petitions of up to 2 million people these days because online petitions are so easy to sign, because they're so easy to run. I mean, you know, they're out there, but, petitions, 2 million people marched against the Gulf War, and the state managed to ignore that because they worked out, 2 million people on the streets, so what? They didn't see a threat. It's very hard to quantify the threat that we maintain, and to actively demonstrate it to the extent that the state begins to have to take notice. And there's a downside also to this, which is that the state might become irrational, that the actors in the state, in the government, might go, well, even if it's not in our best interest, who's in charge here? We're going to stamp our feet and we're going to pass this act anyway, because we think that ultimately we cannot brook any challenge. I mean, ultimately that way leads to civil war, but let's hope it never I don't think that's anything that's on the cards for what we're talking about, but ultimately that's one way it might respond to any popular movement. And one particular issue to bear in mind, I think, is the general support within the population. Now, the last election, we can't ignore that 11 million people voted for the Tory party. That's substantial numbers of workers. I mean, I imagine some of them were doctors who will never vote Tory again now, but there's substantial numbers of workers, and then there's the 4 million voted for UKIP and a couple of million who voted for the Lib Dems, all of these viciously anti-trade union parties. So we have to be aware that these people are out there, and there is a degree of opposition. And you will still find people who'll say, I remember hearing some of my friends up north who talk about, the bloody lefties back in the miners' strike trying to overthrow the elected government. They're very wedded to political democracy, and the state will, and the government will use its mandate to try and ram itself through. So taking to the streets is one option, and, demonstrating a force, but it's not necessarily the easiest. So we come to political action. Of course, the one thing that government ministers and Tory politicians are going to listen to is the threat that they're going to lose their seats. Good grief almighty. For the benefit of the tape, it's a bit grey outside. the storm clouds are gathering.
It's a bit grey, isn't it?
So... One thing that the government ministers will listen to is the actual threat of political electoral defeat. Now, that's one thing that will move them very quickly. But then again, even that might not stop them passing an act. And as we've seen with the previous trade union acts, 13 years of a Labour government, and they were never repealed. Because they were just too useful as a political wedge. And it would have been too much of a fight, I suspect, for the Labour government to even directly alter them. So they chose instead to do quiet favours, like giving funding to the trade unions in the guise of... Well, not in the guise of ads, educational funds and various structural support budgets, which the Tories have rolled back on, which probably was, in real terms, a political mistake. My bloody handwriting... I don't have nice, neat notes like Tosh. I don't. I really must learn a lesson.
I can't see stuff that small.
Yes, but of course, the ultimate political action isn't just to threaten the defeat of the existing government, but to actually take control of the state and become the government. Because there's no surer way of defeating a trade union bill than being a government and saying we won't pass a trade union bill against the government. So we come via this roundabout means to where we are as the Socialist Party, which is, as I said at the start, what we do need is we need a clear class-conscious movement that understands the nature of the wages system, that understands that the class struggle is going on, that understands the way how we are exploited, and how we the only way that we can defeat it, and that is preponderant within society. We need to have the vast majority of people wanting this on our side, because without that, then the government and other parties within the country could well choose to ignore it. But we also need to use political democracy and take political action to take control of the state. But to what end? If we just take control of the state to just prevent the Trade Union Act, or to just support the trade unions as they are, what we'll find is that this will come round again and again and again, because things like the Trade Union Act, things like the Trade Union Labour Relations Act, Taft Vale, all of this are all part of this ongoing struggle, and they are inevitable result of the existence of the clash of interests between ourselves and our employers, as our employers try to push our wages down as far as they can and we try to push them up. And the only way that we can successfully put an end to that is to abolish the wages system itself and have common and democratic ownership, abolish the market system and have rational allocation of our resources around the world for each other, from each according to ability, to each according to the need. And this is not pie-in-the-sky utopian nonsense, but actually the very real and practical need, and that we need to make front and centre of our campaigns, that the reason why we're being attacked through the wages bill, why they're trying to attack the welfare, why they're trying to attack us on all these fronts, is because of the existence of the class struggle, and that if we go to the root of that, then we can finally be free. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.